thousands of Hoosiers losing health care coverage. Lawmakers set to study cannabis again. Plus, Holcomb officially passes on the Senate and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 23rd, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, more than 53,000 Hoosiers were removed from Medicaid in the state's second month of the unwinding process. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Violet Comber-Weiland reports that's in addition to the nearly 53,000 Hoosiers who lost coverage in April.
The federal public health emergency allowed Hoosiers to retain continuous Medicaid coverage, even if they didn't meet certain income or other eligibility requirements. The emergency ended on March 31st, with Indiana beginning to unenroll Medicaid recipients over a 12-month period. The newest data for May shows that over 165,000 Hoosiers were up for renewal. Of those, about 44,000 Hoosiers lost coverage due to procedural reasons, and more than 9,000 were determined ineligible. Those who lost coverage due to procedural reasons, such as lack of updated information or paperwork, have 90 days to update paperwork and could have other coverage in the meantime. If disenrollments continue at this rate, nearly 600,000 Hoosiers could lose their Medicaid coverage.
How concerning are these coverage removals? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwarnes, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Casey Smith, no relation, reporter for the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, is this the sort of thing that's going to have a ripple effect across the entire healthcare industry?
Sure it is. These people have had coverage for now a long time. Since the start of the national emergency. Why they're losing coverage, the state's trying to address. Allison Taylor, the Medicaid director in front of the Budget Committee yesterday, said the state's exploring some options. So if you didn't respond, if you responded inaccurately, because it's not easy, you're getting these forms in the mail and you're having to reapply or attest that you actually do meet the eligibility requirements and you should be able to stay on the rolls. Some people are just going to not know they got rolled off until they go seek care, and then they're going to get a bill. And the provider's not going to know in the moment whether or not they're eligible or not. So I think the state is taking steps to say, okay, well, maybe we need to ask CMS if we can not roll them off, if it's just a procedural issue that we can go then fix, or we get some time frame or an expanded time frame. They're looking at all that now.
Yeah,
in reaction to kind
right.
of what's happening.
And this is not solely Indiana, although Indiana had one of the highest rates of dropped coverage in the country so far. Other states are holding off on even going through this process yet. But the Biden administration this week was asking those states who are dropping people from coverage, if it's a paperwork issue, like, could you give them like 90 days or something?
Right,
like,
right.
could you? Because this is going to have real
problems. Oh, it's going to definitely affect people. And I think the Biden administration's approach is exactly right. And the states, for that matter, reach out to these people because the vast majority of them are procedural or paperwork-oriented, not eligibility-determined. And if we could get them back on. But, I mean, all this points out is why we really need Medicare for All. I mean, this stuff, we shouldn't be going through this stuff. We shouldn't be getting mailings from insurance companies that we don't understand. We shouldn't be having to deal and waste time and effort on all of this. People should have universal coverage. And frankly, it ought to be run like Medicare. I have thought so for a long time, and all of this reinforces that. I mean, the people that you're asking in many cases to fill out the paperwork are already overwhelmed for a variety of different reasons, whether they're medical or work-related, whatever it is. And we need to make sure that we do everything we can, state and federal, to keep these people covered. Otherwise, it's going to be a crisis.
One of the sort of short-term impacts, even if a lot of these people end up coming back on, you talked about some of the reasons, is you're going to go to the hospital, and you're going to find out, oh, I don't have that coverage anymore. And now hospitals are going to have to deal with, because a lot of hospitals right now have counselors who go, okay, let's get you signed up. So those people are about to get overwhelmed too, aren't they?
Yeah, we've talked to a few people, admins in hospitals already, and this has been a concern for them for months already, though. So I think there's been some preparation, but I don't know how effective it's going to be as we see the next couple months roll out. And I know lawmakers said at the end of the session, too, that they were concerned to a certain degree about this happening. So more mitigation maybe on the way.
Yeah. I want to ask partly, is there anything long-term sort of structural changes that might come out of this whole process? But I also want to point out that when we're talking about the people who are being dropped from coverage, we just saw it, and I mean, I think the piece mentions this, in the last month alone, something like 85% of the people who were dropped from the Medicaid rolls in Indiana were because of paperwork issues. Not eligible. They are no longer eligible. There are some of those people, but not those. It's, well, we just didn't hear from you, or you didn't fill this out right. I mean, that's a staggering number, is it not?
It is a staggering number when you think about the percentages involved here. And it does lend some credence to this notion that the administration, the Biden administration, has put forth about finding some way to give these folks some latitude or some wiggle room. The suggestion, therefore, is there a way that some of these problems, these traps, can be mitigated in the future, either through some new application process or some sort of new mechanism by which people can avoid these types of things. That's likely to come up. But let's keep in mind, even with the people who aren't paperwork issues, who just fell off the rolls, the issue here is that the money, the expense doesn't go away, really. I mean, I think a lot of people say, hallelujah, we just cut X. But what happens
we're expecting Medicaid's going to grow exponentially next state.
And it's not just Medicaid. You don't get rid of people.
Right,
they don't
too.
Just disappear.
Right.
So what happens is you have people who probably will put off care, any kind of preventive care, any testing, any sort of, you know, if they're diabetic, if they have heart conditions, if they have breathing conditions, we'll put it off. I can't afford a doctor. Well, they're going to end up in the hospital eventually, and they will be treated, and the care doesn't just magically happen.
Yeah, they're ineligible, I mean, presumably they do qualify then.
Right, then they qualify for healthcare.gov or something
right.
like that.
Right, yeah. or Obamacare, or right. maybe they're now in
place. I'm trying to make sense. The expense doesn't go away.
Not all these people will suddenly be without care entirely.
Right, but it will prevent probably some from seeking the kind of preventive care. And we already know our state is not, we've seen study after study, doing great on the health front. This certainly doesn't push us along that
direction.
Lawmakers
were sounding the alarms for redetermination, for sure, because they were concerned about this exact scenario.
Yeah.
But the fiscal guys in leadership, I mean, Rod Bray said it, what's the number one thing that keeps you up at night? Growing Medicaid costs.
Yep.
Because when you look at the whole pie, the budget pie, you have some like really big competing interests now. Now you've got Medicaid growing exponentially. Well, now K-12 starting to sweat, because where are you going to go for that money? Because there's not a lot of places to go beyond K-12, higher ed, Medicaid, and DOC.
How about vouchers?
After that,
you
got a few bucks left.
You opened that door for
us. How about vouchers?
How about redistricting? What about this redistricting?
How about that? I'd like to see that.
We get the money back from the hog barn.
I think it's been spent by now. All right, for the second year in a row, Indiana lawmakers will examine cannabis legalization during their study committee period, though Republican leaders are still downplaying the possibility of actual legalization. Lawmakers on the Public Health Study Committee spent hours last year hearing testimony from both supporters and opponents of cannabis legalization. This year, the Commerce and Economic Development Study Committee will consider the issue. House Speaker Todd Houston says the focus will be on employment issues and teen use.
You're starting to see real data come out across states that have legalized that I think is important to analyze and understand.
Still, when asked whether the study committee is a step towards legalization, Republican leaders say they're just gathering information. Senate Democratic leader Greg Taylor says while the GOP is focused on the negatives of cannabis use, he's focused on the benefits.
I think cannabis is inevitable.
The committee will meet in the coming months. And Delaney, just getting the lawmakers to even consider the word cannabis felt like a big win a year ago. Now this is 2 years in a row.
Right.
In a row, we're going to have, I mean, genuine, full study committees focused on legalization. Is this real momentum?
It's momentum, yeah. And, you know, it probably helps the momentum that states all around us are having just as well. So it's momentum, and we ought to go ahead with it because it'll add momentum to the notion that the federal government has to deal with this problem, which has to happen first. They have to take it off the listing for controlled substances and legalize it so that banks and the normal business model can be put in place. But I think to the extent that we look at it and we see what's happening around us and we adopt it, it does give some momentum to the federal government to actually deal with the problem, which has to happen.
I agree with Greg Taylor, and we've talked about this before. It does feel inevitable at some point. Is that a lot closer when you consider the moves the General Assembly is making?
Well, I think they're drilling down on two major areas of concern. What does this do to the employees and employer, and therefore employers?
Because the Chamber of Commerce has been one of the leading voices against any sort of legalization.
Right, and so you can counteract that, right, with some good data from other states that is where it's been shown that the impact's not what they think it is. And the second part is teen use or underage use. Is it what happens to the black market? Is it harder to police? Is it easier? The studies show that it actually goes down, like youth use goes down because you're in a regulated environment. They can't actually get it. But I think there are some major blockades here. I mean, the speaker isn't thrilled with this. Generally, he's letting this conversation go forward and actually promoting the conversation in the areas that he is concerned. But there's not universal agreement that this is inevitable in the way that it has been in other states. But what could happen is it gets there is actually a growing concern that it gets rescheduled. Then the feds legalize it. So now we're creating a national framework for it, and now Indiana kind of missed the boat, right? Because we're not creating a homegrown
like
market here, so to speak.
Like the lemon law, weren't we like 38th in adopting that?
It's kind of a game of legal chicken that you're playing with federal government, which is
never
a good.
For 25
years. Yeah, and it's never a good game to play with the federal government because who knows when they're going to do anything on anything. But John, we talk about this on so many issues all the time. Some issues at the State House just take years to happen, and it takes study committees and getting partially through the General Assembly, because it just takes getting lawmakers comfortable with an issue where they feel like, okay, I've got my head around it now, let's move forward. And there's going to be opposition whenever this happens. But how big a step is the fact that this is now 2 years in a row? They're not just saying, oh, let's talk about it in the abstract. They're drilling down into specific issues. Is this real momentum?
Sure. It is real momentum. And I think we've seen that momentum even well prior to the two sessions that you just addressed. I think a big change, we've talked about this before, is for many Republicans, for instance, is when you had some of the veterans groups and who were hardly bastions of liberalism, veterans of foreign wars and Indianapolis-based American Legion saying, you know, we want our members to have this. This gave some political cover. And people started hearing from constituents that, you know, hey, people you wouldn't imagine ever using this or finding relief for ailments
and chronic illness
and so forth.
The bills that were for years, the bills that were authored at the State House for any sort of legalization were solely written by Democrats, mostly by Karen Talion, former senator. And now it's
the state chair of the Democratic Party at one point saying that the three issues that they were going to push were marijuana.
That was a terrible idea, by the way.
Keep in mind that this isn't just about whether decriminalization or legalization, I guess, is even more complicated because you have to set up, and this is not a surprise to members of the General Assembly, this is what they're anticipating, the regulatory system and the distribution system and the production. I mean, those are big dollar. Remember how when we first entered into legal gaming and who's going to get casino licenses? Well, when you look at other states, who's going to grow it? Who's going to distribute it? Is it just going to be an open market, or will it be sort of, you know, set number of licenses will
who's
be given
going
to?
Who's going to monitor it, too?
Right. And
who's
so these are all issues that are very, it's more than just can you smoke or not.
Anne pointed out that there is increasing pressure in Indiana to do this because most or all of our surrounding states have at least taken step towards some sort of legalization of cannabis at this point. But is it also helping Indiana? Instead of the pressure, is it also helping because Indiana doesn't love to be first on most things?
It
doesn't,
gaming.
Except for gaming and maybe a couple other things. But it loves when it can go, okay, a bunch of other states have done this. Let's see the good and the bad of how they did it. How much is that going to help this process move forward a little quicker?
I think a little bit. And that was the conversation we heard earlier in the session when there was the committee discussion a little bit there about marijuana for a second. We heard that from some on both sides of the aisle, lawmakers, that was potentially a benefit for them. But then also in the session, we saw that Kratom bill that also ended up going nowhere, not the same wheelhouse necessarily, but similar.
Yeah.
They couldn't even get enough traction to push that through. And we're one of the, if not the last state to still have kratom illegal here. So
maybe not. Yeah, it's hard to read. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, should Indiana legalize cannabis in some form? A, yes for medicinal use only. B, yes for adult recreational use. Or C, no, they shouldn't. Last week's question, can Curtis Hill win the Republican nomination for governor? Just 9% of you say yes, 91% say no. I am not nearly as confident as that 91% on that question. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Eric Holcomb, speaking of governor, Eric Holcomb says he's too busy as governor to run for Indiana's open U.S. Senate seat in 2024. That's why the term-limited governor says he made that decision, which was first reported by the Indiana Capital Chronicle and a reporter named Casey Smith. Congressman Jim Banks is the only Republican currently running for the open Senate seat, and with former Governor Mitch Daniels passing on a bid, many turned to Holcomb to give Banks some competition. But Holcomb says he's focused on his current job.
If I was sitting around throwing pencils in the ceiling tile, maybe I would have had time to think about something else, but right now I'm going to finish the job that I started.
The governor says it's not yet time for him to consider what his next step will be, but that he expects to have options. Casey, you drove all the way out to the Greencastle area to talk to the governor first about this last week, but are you surprised at all that he's just taken a pass?
Maybe a little bit, but based on some of the comments that I thought that he had, the implication of some comments he made earlier this year that seemed to be more federally or nationally focused, it's kind of, I thought, was setting the stage for maybe a Senate run. I also asked him, though, you know, has he closed the door on a run post-2024? And he said no. So I think I would have been more surprised if he said he had closed the door on something after 24. He's also endorsed Mike Pence for president, so maybe he has other aspirations potentially in that realm, should something happen there. But
I'll say this. If he's waiting on a Mike Pence presidency.
He better have a plan B.
Yes.
I imagine he has other options that he's probably exploring before that. Let me ask about that comment, because that struck me too in your story, which was he's not running in 2024. You made that abundantly clear. But he's leaving it open for the future. I don't think Todd Young's going anywhere. Whoever gets in 24, assuming it's Jim Banks at this point, I would guess he wants to be there for more than a term. It would be a while before there's an open seat again, theoretically. So wasn't it kind of now or never?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he's not. I mean, we've kind of come warp perhaps in our perception, but this is not a do or die moment for him, I think. He's still relatively young. I mean, he's not barely, you know, he'd never be taken seriously as a presidential candidate because he's not well into his
70s.
He's
30 years too young.
Yeah, he's 30 years too young. So he's got plenty of time. But I do think he will. I mean, politics is in his blood. You look at, as soon as he got out of the Navy, I think his first job was working in a congressional office. And he's worked in and around politics, not as an elected official necessarily, but in that ecosystem the whole time. You don't just, when you're that hooked on that drug, you don't just give it up. So he'll be back, or maybe I should say he'll never go away. It just may be, in some manner, we'll be around the process. I don't think, unless he gets that surprise NBA contract, and I noticed his name did not show up on the ticker in the NBA draft, something around public policy is where we'll see him.
Mike, I think it's fair to say you know the governor a little bit. What do you think makes sense for Eric Holcomb post his time as governor?
I think he's working through that right now and thinking through that. But I also think this is a guy who has lived a year where if you would have said no or no, I'm never going to do that, it would have been insane. And that year was 2016. If I was sitting here in 2015, we're all trying to predict what's going to happen in. We're sitting here in 2023, we're trying to predict what will happen in 24. If I sat here in 15 trying to predict what would happen in 16, I would have gotten literally everything wrong because we started that year with Sue Ellsworth and Mike Pence running for lieutenant governor and governor. 2 months later, Eric Holcomb and Mike Pence are running for governor and lieutenant governor. Three months later, Eric Holcomb and Suzanne Crouch are running for governor and lieutenant governor. So it would have been foolish based on his own life experience to say, no, I have no plans at 54 years old to to run for public office again.
I'll say this. It felt like Holcomb was the last Republican who could have given Jim Banks any sort of contest in that primary. I think I asked this when Mitch Daniels took a pass. I'll ask it again now. Are you surprised that in a wide-open U.S. Senate seat in the state of Indiana that the Republican primary is going to clear a path for one person?
They've conceded the Republican primary to the right wing. That's what they've done. They're afraid. This was the best shot Eric Holcomb had if he ever wanted to go to the U.S. Senate. And that's fine. You know, maybe lightning will strike. Maybe Jim Banks will, God forbid, would have a heart attack. Maybe there are things like that.
What is wrong with you?
But that's what it would take. If he didn't make the move this year, he's not running again, period. Okay? So the reason he didn't make the run this year is not because he can't multitask. I know the rap on men is that they can't do that, but I think he could have run for governor and senator at the same time. Probably
yeah,
would
but
have
then
had
you would have criticized him for running
probably
for governor.
Would have had, well, he's not done anything while he's there, so what's he had all the time in the world? So it, you know, he could raise money a lot more easily, too. So he's not running again. And the Republican Party has conceded the state of Indiana to the right-wing crazies. Period.
The thing I will agree with is it does seem like it would take an act of God at this point for Jim Banks to not at least get the nomination for U.S. Senate as a Republican.
God help us all.
An Indiana chapter of the national group Moms for Liberty is facing backlash after quoting Adolf Hitler in their newsletter. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Kirsten Adair reports the group apologized after the Indiana Democratic Party and local politicians denounced the group's use of the quote.
The Hamilton County chapter included this quote from Hitler on the front page of its newsletter. "He alone who owns the youth gains the future." After backlash, the chapter kept the Hitler quote but added an explanation that it was meant to put parents on alert so they will remain vigilant and protect their children from government overreach. Soon after, Moms for Liberty apologized and removed the quote. Critics like Democratic State Senator J.D. Ford condemned the chapter's use of the quote. Ford said in a statement, 6 million Jewish people lost their lives because of the rhetoric and ideals that were pushed by Hitler. The statement went on to say that Americans fought in World War II specifically to stop Hitler's hateful anti-Semitic language and views. The national founders of Moms for Liberty say their goal is to empower parents to get involved in education. The group has been labeled as an extremist group by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
John Schwanis, there was an apology from the group about, I don't know, less than 24 hours after the newsletter was out there. Is this issue over and done?
Yeah, well, I don't know. It serves as a reminder, and Anne has the definitive book, of course, Politics for Dummies, which is now will be in its fourth edition. I have a first if anyone ever wants to bid on it. But if maybe the new book should have a chapter that says,
"Don't quote
if you
Adolf
ever,
Hitler.
Ever, ever are thinking about quoting Adolf Hitler in the political sphere.
At all. Yeah.
We'll get you a Bartlett's. We'll get you another 1,000 quotes that aren't from Hitler and from people on the world hate list who can talk about the importance of bringing youth up the right way or the influence that adults, right-minded adults, can have on youth, et cetera. So there's your next chapter you need to work on.
Thank you.
So I asked, is this over? And then I saw the national group here today, as we tape this on Friday, a little earlier today, accused the Indy Star of sort of irresponsible journalism for writing about this, I guess, and said that the use of the quote was wrong and noted that the group apologized, the local chapter apologized, but also was sort of defending the use of the quote. So I'll ask again, is this over?
They hope not.
it's not something I enjoy writing about. I think for the Star, though, I read the multiple iterations of the story from the start of the day through the end of the day, the continuous coverage. They just reported on what was said in the newsletter, got more context once they were able to get a hold of the Moms for Liberty group up in Hamilton County and, you know, went throughout the day with that. But I think this is a group that we've seen at the State House a lot during session on multiple issues, a lot of education issues, for example. I don't think they're going away. To be seen what, I guess, will come in the coming session.
That's kind of the context here, too, is we're not just picking on some random tiny group that doesn't matter to anybody. This is an increasingly influential group in some circles, primarily in central Indiana, here in Indiana anyway. We're seeing them in school board races. They had some success in school board races last year. But at the same time, is this just a symbol of they made a stupid mistake, they apologized, it's over?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it's a window to their soul. They're absolutely tone deaf. They've confused freedom with anger. And they're angry. They're angry about everything. They're angry at teachers. They're angry at school boards. They're angry at the legislature, the government, without any real thought about it. And to use that quote and attribute it to Adolf Hitler is unforgivable.
Well, and the thing that struck me, though, too, is, and I'm not going to say it's Moms for Liberty necessarily that we saw this, but the last couple of years, from folks particularly anger over, like, COVID and vaccines and masks, they, quote, they cite, oh, it's all about Nazi Germany all over again, which it really isn't. That's Indiana
Week. Of Mice and Men is on the shelf of the Carmel High School library.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Casey Smith of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.